Let me say at the outset, it's a pleasure to be here tonight. And I will be talking, although hopefully not as seriously, I think, as was communicated, because there is some humor and excitement to what I want to talk about tonight, about all kinds of very fascinating and confusing research on the topics of biofeedback and meditation and related phenomena of the conscious control of our physiological processes. And specifically, I'm going to talk about some of the mechanisms, some of the ways by which we go about controlling our mind and therefore controlling our bodies in ways that we normally don't think about, and in fact, in ways that we may be biologically ill-equipped to think about them. Matter of fact, the point that I wish to explore tonight is the concept that all of us, all of the time, are continually self-regulating a whole pattern of brain processes in our heads, and that these patterns of activity...
I think we'll put this on.
Okay.
Can we just put it over?
Can you hear me better? Good. And that these patterns of brain processes have some very unique and unexpected properties when we think about them. Now, as I said, we are constantly controlling these brain processes as part of our daily activity, but we never think about it. In fact, we're not at all consciously aware that we are continually controlling our brains. For example, when I move my hand, what you see is me moving my arm in three-dimensional space. At least I hope most of you see that. What do I experience? I experience in a gestalt sense an eye somewhere inside me moving a hand out in three-dimensional space. But you know what I'm really doing? I'm really controlling my brain. I'm in fact regulating a complex pattern of neural activity inside my head, which is then being transmitted like a set of telephone wires down to a set of muscles which happen to move. Or, if I go about the process of rubbing my stomach with one hand and patting my head with the other, you see me doing a behavioral trick in three-dimensional space. It looks a little silly. I also, needless to say, feel a little silly doing that. I also experience a hand out here and another hand up here. But what I'm really doing is I'm doing neural gymnastics with my brain. With the left side of my hemisphere, I'm controlling one pattern, which is attached to my right hand. On the right side of my brain, I'm doing something else, which is attached to the left side. But I have no conscious awareness of it, nor for that matter do you. Now, when I go about closing my eyes and thinking a happy thought, for example, I'm also, although I'm not aware of it, as are you, generating another pattern of brain processes, both what we call cortical up on the top and subcortical down below. But none of us are aware of that, and we don't think about that. And so consequently, we're very surprised when we hear people say, the mind can affect the body, or psychology can affect physiology. When in point of fact, whether we control our arm or whether we think a thought, in both cases, we're controlling our brain. Well, as I said, we don't normally think about that, and I must confess that 5 years ago, I didn't think about that. But some of the research that I'm going to describe to you today, tonight, on biofeedback on meditation forces us to that conclusion. Even though, despite the fact of having spent many years now on this problem, I don't feel my brain. And I suspect at the end of the evening, probably either will you, except possibly getting a headache, hearing all of the complications I'm about to describe. Well, what's biofeedback? Biofeedback is essentially a new procedure based on modern 20th century technology for recording physiological processes that we're not normally consciously aware of, and then converting them into forms of information which we can now experience in our conscious brains. So, for example, if I asked all of you in the audience, what is your blood pressure at the present moment? Most of you could not tell me. Most of you can't feel your blood pressure. But if I record your blood pressure using biomedical instrumentation and then provide you with visual information, feedback of what your blood pressure is doing, you can now see your blood pressure for the first time. And it turns out by being able to have that information, that additional feedback, you can now learn to control that blood pressure in ways that you couldn't do before. Let me describe to you from the search that we did at the Harvard Medical School, Drs. David Shapiro, Bernie Tursky, and myself, to illustrate some of the confusion that initially came out and some of the conclusions that were the result of that. Imagine you're a college undergraduate male. This is around 1969. You're put into a room. You're sitting down in a chair. You've got electrodes all over your body. You've got a blood pressure cuff on you. You've got EKG attached to recording your heart rate. We're recording sweat gland activity from you. We've got things around your chest recording your breathing and so on. In front of you is a square, a triangle, and a screen for a slide. You're given the following instructions. We say, whenever this little square goes on, what we want you to do is to try to control your physiology. We don't tell you what the response is that you're going to control. We don't tell you what direction it is to change, because we're interested specifically in seeing what the feedback can do if you know nothing else. Well, how do you know whether you're succeeding or not in controlling your physiology? Well, this little triangle comes on. And also you hear a tone, sort of a psychedelic kind of display, that tells you each time you're doing the right thing. Well, as an incentive for making this feedback occur, we're going to give you a reward in the form of a slide, which will come on for a brief period of 3 seconds every, let's say, 20 feedbacks. Now, in the late 60s, we're using male college undergraduates, one of the most effective and inexpensive reinforcers we could use, where a variety of pictures have taken from Playboy magazine. However, times quickly changed. Playboy was outmoded. We ended up having to go to a really psychedelic display. We ended up using a potpourri of rewards, including from pictures of Boston, pictures from around the world, landscapes, art pictures, a nude female, a monetary bonus. The subject never knew what was going to happen next, and that worked quite well. But even then, people got tired of that. And you know what we now use as the most effective motivator? Free play. The childish desire to go about controlling these complex processes. So to speak, beat the machine and beat your own body. However, as we will see, and I will end the talk with that, motivation turns out to be the key problem in applying all of the techniques that I will describe to you tonight to increasing our health and our own self-awareness. Well, in this first group of subjects, what we did is we gave one group of subjects feedback whenever their blood pressure was decreasing, their systolic blood pressure. And another group of subjects, we gave the feedback only when their blood pressure was increasing. And much to our amazement, after only about 30 to 35 minutes of feedback, the subjects were now controlling their blood pressure. The group given feedback for increasing its blood pressure showed a slight rise. The group giving feedback for lowering its blood pressure showed a decrease. Most of our amazement also is when we looked at heart rate, which is one component of blood pressure, we found there were no changes in heart rate. The subjects had controlled their systolic blood pressure without controlling their heart rate. In other words, the feedback had been quite specific. So when we said, well, gee, what are they doing to control the feedback? So we asked them. You know what we found out? There were no differences that we could detect between the subjects trained to increase their blood pressure and the subjects trained to decrease them in their own subjective feelings. Matter of fact, most of these students didn't believe they had any control of their blood pressure whatsoever. Well, we were amazed because we had been taught that people can't control their blood pressure. We were also amazed that people need to be consciously aware of what they're doing. And here we had these strange subjects. So we went out to replicate the results. And much to our disbelief, we replicated. So we said, wait a minute, let's turn it around. Let's give the feedback and reward for increases and decreases in heart rate while we measure their systolic blood pressure. What do the subjects do now? Much to our amazement, the subjects now, within 35 minutes, learn to control their heart rate. No differences in their blood pressure. We can't ask them what they're doing, thinking, and feeling. We can't find any differences between the two groups. Again, most people don't believe they're controlling the feedback. We said, wait a minute. What happens if we get the really good blood pressure controllers? Do they show changes in heart rate? No. What about our good heart rate controllers? Do they show changes in their blood pressure? The answer was no. And thus we had, much to our amazement, evidence for selective voluntary control of complex physiological processes for all practical purposes without awareness, with just the additional input of this new biofeedback loop. Well, these data were very exciting because they suggested the possibility that we might be able to clinically apply these procedures to the behavioral treatment of various cardiovascular and other psychosomatic disorders. And there weren't any other researchers around the country who were coming to similar conclusions. However, being able to control single functions was not the only answer, because there are certain kinds of problems where you don't want to produce specificity. You want to teach a person to control a pattern. For example, if you were a patient that had angina pectoris, which literally translated means pain in the heart, it turns out that what you want to do, so the cardiologists tell us, ideally is to lower the product of your blood pressure and your heart rate. In other words, reduce the total work that your heart is doing to therefore reduce the pain. Consequently, we don't want to teach you just to lower your heart rate or just to lower your blood pressure. We want to teach you the pattern. Well, how do we do that? Well, one approach is to give you the feedback only when the specific pattern of blood pressure and heart rate happen to be occurring. So now you have to have not only these systems for measuring the physiology, but you have to have systems for measuring the relationships between the physiology, and then give the feedback, for example, only when your blood pressure is down and your heart rate is simultaneously down at that instantaneous moment and no other time. And so we developed this equipment to develop these patterns, whether they're both going up, both going down, one going up and the other going down, or vice versa. We gave people feedback, and we looked to see what happened. Much to our amazement, subjects now learned, within the course of 35 minutes, to control the relationship between their blood pressure and their heart rate. They could voluntarily make both systems go up, make both systems go down, or to a lesser extent, make them both go in the opposite direction. However, some interesting, unexpected results grew out of this study, and this is where we get to that concept of patterns. The first thing we found is that when people are controlling both their blood pressure and their heart rate simultaneously, they learn more quickly, and they show bigger changes when they're going in the same direction than given feedback for either one alone. Similarly, when you try to pull them apart and you give feedback for the pattern, you know what happens? It becomes more difficult to pull them apart, which means you begin to uncover a constraint between blood pressure and heart rate that you didn't see before when you're giving feedback for either one alone. But the other thing that was really intriguing is that when you ask these subjects what they were doing, thinking, and feeling to control their blood pressure, you know what you now find? The subjects who were lowering both their blood pressure and their heart rate simultaneously now begin to report feelings of calmness, relaxation, quietness, thoughts you'd expect to be associated with more general physiological relaxation. And so one of the conclusions that grew out of this research was that, first of all, biofeedback for training people to control patterns of responses might be a new and unique research tool for A, uncovering the relationships between our physiological processes without resorting to things like cutting open the brain or giving people drugs. And secondly, by training people to control different patterns of physiological responses, we might be able to uncover the relationship between our physiology and our conscious experience. Well, there are a couple of other approaches now for teaching people to control patterns, and this gets into clinical applications. One approach is to give people training for those things that they can do easily, and then go on to train them for those things that they find more difficulty in doing. One of these applications currently under research consideration is being done by doctors Johann Stoiber and Thomas Budzinski, both prior presidents of the Biofeedback Research Society at the Colorado Medical School. They're interested in trying to teach people who are insomniac to fall asleep better with biofeedback. And needless to say, if you're going to fall asleep, you have to have reductions in all kinds of physiological processes, and obviously, therefore, reductions in your brain. Well, what they find is that if a person is muscularly tense and cognitively all alert, so he's got a lot of muscle tension, a lot of high heart rate, a lot of high activity in the EEG in the brain, what he does is they first train you to lower the tension in your muscles in your forearm with biofeedback. That you can do readily, easily. After you've learned that, now they give you feedback for reducing muscle tension in your forehead. That proves to be more difficult. After you've learned that, then they give you feedback for theta activity in your EEG. Now, what's theta? Theta is a very low frequency in the EEG, which tends to occur when people get drowsy, just before they fall asleep. And having learned to relax the forearm and the forehead and their heart rate goes down, now they learn you learn to increase your theta activity and therefore go to sleep. A third approach, and that gets to us to the next topic, which is the relationship between our brain activity and our physiology, is what we call coordination training. And that goes out of the model of, how would I go about teaching you to learn a complex skill like rubbing your stomach with one hand and patting your head with the other? Well, one way to do that, probably the simplest way, and the way I learned it, is you practice each one alone till you get it good, and then you put it together. You coordinate the two. And as I said, what is that? Well, that's a complex brain coordination. And we said, well, gee, if we develop such a coordination procedure, we should be able to teach people, for example, to control the relationship between EEG activity and their heart rate, and therefore be able to find the relationship, something out about the relationship between brainwave activity and the heart. So Dr. Jim Hassett and I went out and did an experiment where we first trained people to control alpha. Now, alpha is a slightly higher frequency of the brainwave than theta. It occurs under sort of relaxed states, but not necessarily a drowsy state. It's in the area of what's called 8 to 13 cycles per second in the EEG. We first trained people to either control their alpha or their heart rate using just simple alpha or heart rate feedback. Then we trained them to control the other response. Then we gave them two sets of feedback, one for alpha, one for heart rate, and had people control the relationship. And you know what we found? Within two sessions, the average college student could learn to produce all eight patterns of alpha heart rate regulation on command. He could increase and decrease his alpha without affecting his heart rate, increase and decrease his heart rate without affecting his alpha, make them both go together, make them go down, and make them both go in opposite directions. Well, you want to know something that we found out interesting about that? And that was, we asked the people subjectively, which of these states feels most relaxing? You know what we found? Subjects almost universally reported that slowing their heart rate and increasing their alpha from this high-frequency activity, that pattern was more relaxing than any of the other components. Matter of fact, one of the girls that we trained, and these were, again, without any instructions, one of these girls, after eight sessions of training, found that this one particular pattern was very relaxing, and she started practicing that pattern without the feedback, needless to say, on the subways going back between Cambridge and Boston. She spontaneously found it to be relaxing, that pattern. Well, that taught us something, and I'd like to communicate what I think it taught us. And that is some of the fallacies that you may have seen in the public in the popularization of biofeedback. Many of you may have heard about alpha feedback, learn to relax, learn to meditate with alpha. Well, let me tell you how the logic goes. Logic goes as follows. When people meditate, for example, with transcendental meditation, one of the physiological changes that are often observed is an increase in alpha over much of the brain. That's proposition one. That's true. Second proposition, which is also true, is that if I give you feedback for alpha, you can learn to control your alpha. That's also true. The third proposition, which people jumped on, was therefore, with biofeedback, what I will have is an instant electronic yogi. The problem with that argument is that biofeedback, as I told you, leads to specificity, not necessarily patterning. Whereas transcendental meditation doesn't just produce an increase in alpha. Transcendental meditation is associated with a complex pattern of physiological processes. And therefore, if you wanted to teach a person with biofeedback to do what he's doing when he's doing transcendental meditation, you'd have to give him feedback for or train him to decrease multiple physiological systems. Then you begin to think about that and you say, well, maybe that's kind of silly to go out and if you want to train a person to lower multiple functions by giving him feedback for everything in his body, maybe it's simpler just to teach him how to do TM. That conclusion is going to lead us to the next part of this discussion. But the point I want you to leave you with now is that relaxation is not low blood pressure, it's not low oxygen, it's not low muscle tension, it's not a decrease in all of these systems. It's the combination, it's the integration, it's what people call the emergent property, a unique sense of pattern that we think produces these changes. Well, how do people control these patterns? What's going on in their heads that would enable us to do all of these crazy biofeedback gymnastics with the aid of these changes? What goes on? How do we do it? Do we do it simply by direct control without any conscious awareness? Or are we employing all kinds of strategies on our behalf that will aid us to control these physiology? Well, I'm suggesting to you that maybe that we do that, and that from a clinical perspective, that's in fact what we want to do. And let me give you the example, one example. Let's say that you're a therapist and a patient comes to you who wants to learn to reduce his weight. And what we all know, we should know, is that there are two almost, for most people, absolutely effective ways of learning to reduce weight, reducing your weight. One is to cut down on your eating. The second is to increase your exercise. You put the two of them together, and if you've got a normal, healthy body, most of us will learn to lose weight, will lose weight. Well, how do you and your therapist know that you're succeeding in losing weight? You get feedback, biofeedback, for example, by standing on a scale. And the scale tells you that, in fact, you are succeeding in reducing your weight, right? Well, the simple biofeedback approach might be stand on the scale for 1 or 2 hours at a time, and purely through thought processes alone, try to voluntarily make your weight go away. And then as a reward, what do you do? You go out and eat a big piece of apple pie. I don't think that's going to work in the long run. And it's also not going to work for a lot of our physiological processes. In fact, what we need to do is to use the feedback as a way of teaching us what to control in a whole variety of factors that will lead us to improve our health. The instant in my clinical work that convinced me that that had to be the case and that was what I had to do next in my own research came from a particular clinical patient who we were experimentally treating for Raynaud's disease. And I'd like to tell you about that patient. Raynaud's disease, as some of you may know, is a disorder in which there is peripheral constriction of the blood vessels, typically in the hands and the feet. This constriction can be so extreme, the symptoms of cold, your hands get white. It can be so extreme that it can be quite painful, very painful. If it continues for any length of time, surgical intervention may be required, such as sympenthectomy. And in fact, gangrene in certain cases can set in and require amputation. It can be a very serious disorder. Well, man came to us about the time that we were doing these early studies with blood pressure, suffering from Raynaud's disease. It was a very interesting case, early 60s, gentleman. The interesting thing was that he was a practicing psychoanalyst who came to a so-called behavior therapist for treatment of his problem. So you can be sure that this was a last-ditch effort. Well, I must confess, we were just learning about the cardiovascular system at that point, trying to find out how blood pressure worked. We didn't know too much about blood flow to the extremities. But we said, sure, we'll try it. And so we recorded blood flow from the big toes of each of his feet. That's where he had most of his trouble. And we set it up with this potpourri of rewards with the nude females and everything else going on as an incentive for him to control his blood flow. And we said, look, what we want you to do is to try to keep this light on. And that indicates that you're doing the right thing in terms of dilating your feet. He said, sure. We weren't quite sure if he really understood us because he saw the world from a very different perspective than we did. And we never knew whether we were talking in the same language. Nonetheless, he went into the room religiously and sat down and started controlling his feet. And much to our amazement, he very rapidly, within about a course of 10 sessions, began to learn to dilate his feet, that is, increase the blood flow, primarily to the left foot, the foot that was given feedback and reward. That didn't too much surprise us, because it turned out that you can have constrictions or dilations in one foot which are not correlated with the other foot. And so therefore, when you're giving feedback for one foot, you're not also giving the feedback for the other foot as well, right? Well, he didn't know what foot we were doing, but anyway, in the middle of one of the later sessions, we changed over the feedback to the right foot, and now, and again, over a course of 6 to 10 sessions, the right foot warmed up, and he did very well. He came out, much to us, and showed dramatic clinical improvement. Now, of course, there were all kinds of other factors going on here, what we call placebo effects, expectancy. We were giving him tender, loving care. We were rooting for him. And there were all of that going on in the treatment. But nonetheless, there was something also linked up to the specific feedback that led him to control his blood flow. Now, where does this story come in about the patterns and the cognitive mediation? Well, this man, being a psychoanalyst, we found out, tended to be very prone toward free association. And what he did was he interpreted the purpose of those slides as being stimuli for him to free associate to. You can imagine what that must have been like. So, if a slide of money came on, he would immediately start thinking about money. And then if the slide changed and the picture of Boston came on, then he'd change his thoughts and start free associating to Boston. If a nude female came on, he was immediately free associating to sex. God only knows what was going on in his head, but it was very different than the average patient that we had coming into the laboratory. Well, about the middle of the training sessions, the slide projector accidentally broke. And rather than showing a slide, just a bright white light flashed on the screen. He, of course, began immediately associating to what? The sun, the beach, warmth, and so on. And he claimed that those particular thoughts were very effective in warming up his feet. So he didn't want the slides anymore. We kept the slides out. And he developed a set of what he called hot thoughts. Now, these hot thoughts were very adaptive, because he could take them with him wherever he went. And so if his feet got cold, and this is the best part of it, even while he was doing therapy, you know, a patient lying down on the couch, free associating to him, what did he do? He just sort of quietly tuned the patient out, generated his hot thoughts, come back to the patient, and everything was just fine. But we didn't know, and we weren't bright enough then, I must confess, to really go out and determine whether those specific cognitive thoughts were associated with specific patterns of brain activity and whether they really were associated with warming his feet. But they did strike me as being very similar to a certain German tradition called autogenic training, which some of you may have heard of, in which some of the imagery that's used for lowering one's blood pressure and so on is to imagine that one's hands are heavy and warm. And then I remembered back to my days when I was in high school, actually in grade school, and I had first read a book about hypnosis. And I read about how hypnotic suggestion in certain individuals could lead people to show specific changes in their hands. And this, by the way, has been recently replicated. For certain people, if you tell them to imagine that one hand is on an ice cube and another hand is on a flame, you will see constriction in one hand and dilation in another, just because of the imagery. There, you see, maybe the possibility occurs that certain patterns of brain activity which goes on in our own thinking can be utilized to aid us in using biofeedback or other procedures for the sake of our health. In the same way that learning to control one's weight is really helped by reducing one's food intake or increasing one's exercise. Well, unfortunately, there were very few experiments in psychology and in psychophysiology that showed any evidence for how thoughts could be associated and produce these kinds of changes. And that stimulated my students at Harvard to do work in a variety of areas, including meditation, which is what I will get to shortly, about how these changes might take place. Let me tell you two specific instances, examples. One is in the area of what's called hemispheric asymmetry. Some of you may have heard about this. It turns out that we are built with actually two brains, one on the left side and one on the right side, connected by what's called the corpus callosum. The left side and the right side of our brains, it turns out, are not unitary. They end up doing different things. And in the average right-handed person, we use our left hand for talking, my left side of our hemisphere, for talking, for doing logical kinds of thought, sequential kinds of thought. It takes place on this side of our brains. Whereas the right side of the brain is much more involved with spatial things, pictures, gestalt feelings, and other emotional processes, including music. Well, we started thinking, if that's true, for example, that talking involves the left hemisphere, for example, and music, like whistling, involves the right hemisphere, then what's singing? Is singing like rubbing your stomach and patting your head? Are you coordinating your left hemisphere and your right hemisphere by talking and doing music at the same time? How would we ever test that? Well, we decided to start recording EEG from the left side and the right side of the head, brainwave activity. And we had students either whistle a song or speak the lyrics to a song in a monotone, but not sing them, or sing. By the way, most people feel very silly about doing that in a laboratory, particularly with electrodes on the head. They nonetheless complied. Much to our amazement, when people talk the lyrics to a song in a monotone, they show relative EEG activation on the left sides of their brains. When we whistle a song, we show relative activation on the right side of our brains. And when we sing, we tend to show activation on both sides, particularly if it's a difficult song, requiring that we attend to both the words and the music. So here we see the idea that we can have patterns of brainwave activity associated, and in fact, the underlying processes of what we do when we talk, or we whistle, or we sing. Well, as I said, emotion tends to be involved with the right hemisphere, but that's the grossest of oversimplifications. Emotion's much more complicated than that. We have happy emotions, sad emotions, angry emotions, fearful emotions. Those feelings and those changes should also be, if this approach is reasonable, a specific pattern of physiological changes. And even thinking a happy thought, and we begin to feel happy, versus thinking a sad thought, beginning to feel sad, those should have different physiological patterns as well. Well, the question is, where do you look? Well, unfortunately, at this point in time, we don't know how to get activity from the lower parts of the brain recorded from the surface of the scalp, short of sticking electrodes through the skull. And the average college student, matter of fact, the average person, will not volunteer for such experiments. But there are more peripheral manifestations of our thinking, but we're not normally aware of them. And we came up with the idea, this was at the Harvard Medical School with Professors Gerald Clareman and Paul Fair and a number of my other colleagues. We began thinking about work that had been coming out now on facial expression. As most of you probably know, a happy face is different from a sad face, and a sad face is different than an angry face, and an angry face is different than a fearful face. We can control our facial expressions, which means we use our brain to control different facial expressions. But it turns out these facial expressions in their patterns are unique and they're innate. Babies all across the world cry by putting their mouths down. And babies all across the world smile with their mouths up. And regardless of the culture, if you see someone with a face like this, it's genuinely judged as being happy as opposed to angry. Something universal there. And we said, well, gee, if the face, which is so sensitive to expression of emotion, is involved with emotion, and matter of fact, an old theory which has now been revitalized is that maybe part of our subjective experience of emotion is feedback from our muscles in those specific patterns that go back into our head and are experienced as a gestalt in an emotional state. Well, what would happen if we were to put electrodes on different muscles of people's faces while they were thinking different emotional thoughts? Would we find that when a person thinks about a happy thought and begins to feel happy, unbeknownst to either me looking at you or you yourself, that your brain would be generating subtle patterns, sort of a miniature, covert, happy face, which we could pick up with our physiological equipment and look at the patterns and define them as such? And if we could detect these patterns of facial activity associated with mood or emotion, could we therefore apply them to understanding, let's say, the etiology of affective disorder, like anxiety and depression? Could we use these procedures to help assess whether an antidepressant drug was in fact changing a patient's emotional state? That was our hope. And so we began to do research. And let me just summarize the very first experiment that we did. We had people think happy thoughts, sad thoughts, angry thoughts. And as a control condition, so we thought, we had people just think about what you do in a typical day. Getting up in the morning, you know, putting on your slippers, brushing your teeth, and so on. We were told, and during this typical day period, you weren't instructed to feel anything in specific, just to think the images. We ran one group of subjects who had reported on a set of scales to be happy and normal and so on, and a second group of individuals who appeared clinically depressed. And we looked at the patterns of facial muscle activity to the different thought processes. What did we find? Well, in our non-depressed group, we found that when people think happy thoughts, they generate a covert pattern of facial muscle activity that's in fact different than when you think sad thoughts. The sad thoughts generated a different pattern than the angry thoughts. You know what we found when people thought about a typical day? It wasn't flat. There was a miniature happy pattern. We then look at our depressed people. We ask depressed people to think about sad thoughts and angry thoughts. They generate beautiful sad patterns, beautiful angry patterns. You ask a depressed person to think about something that in the past made him happy, you see a very attenuated happy pattern. And lo and behold, what happens when you ask a depressed person to think about what they do in a typical day? The resulting EMG, muscle tension pattern, is a miniature sad pattern. In other words, thinking and generating a set of thoughts associated with a different pattern of facial muscle activity, which might be the underlying component of the subtle experience that we call emotion. And also that our capability to control our brains and to control our thinking, therefore, in part depends on our own emotional state. We all know that when we're depressed, it's hard to think a happy thought. And when we're really happy, who thinks about sad things? There's a two-way interaction there to come out. Well, how does this all apply then to what we call in meditation, which is the next point I want to lead to now? We now see that we use different hemispheres when we involve different kinds of thinking. Emotion involves different patterns of facial muscle activity. Can't the same be said for something like meditation? The answer I suggest is yes. Like the biofeedback area, a lot of the claims, I think, that are made in the popular press, both by the proponents of certain meditation schools and the reporters who report them, are oversimplistic and are, in fact, in many cases, wrong. If you'd like, later on, you can ask me some specific cases of where I think that's true and where it's not. On the other hand, there are also truths to what's being said, and it's for us to try to fathom out what's the truth and what's an error. Well, in transcendental meditation, what people typically do, it's a very simple procedure. You sit quietly with your eyes closed. You sit. You don't lie down. The reason why you don't lie down is because you'd very quickly fall asleep. And so consequently, you don't want to fall asleep. And so the way what you do is you sit up, and that maintains enough muscle tone to keep the brain from falling over into that third state of consciousness, which we call sleeping. You are then given by your teacher of meditation a special word called a mantra, a Sanskrit word, which is a meaningless sound. Actually, it's not meaningless originally, but it's meaningless to you, which you are told is carefully selected for you and only you, based on a procedure that only the teacher of meditation knows. You are never to tell your mantra to anyone. And for that, you pay $125. It's reduced rates for other individuals, like students and so on. And what you do with this mantra is you silently, it's a word, it's a thought, you can picture it, maybe it involves our left hemisphere under quiet conditions with eyes closed and we're not moving too much. You say this thought over and over in your head in a passive, quiet way. And if other thoughts come into your mind, you're instructed, that's okay, sort of ignore the thoughts and come back to your mantra. And so you attend to your mantra, and you attend to your mantra, and you attend to your mantra. And what do you end up doing? You end up learning a new neuropsychological skill of generating a single word over and over again in an effortless manner. And not surprising, because you're sitting quietly and you're looking at things in a passive way and you're decreasing all kinds of activity, you end up being more relaxed. And the relaxation that occurs with transcendental meditation, I think, is true. It is transcendental meditation, though, not the only means of inducing relaxation. There are many other procedures. And some of these procedures work for different people under different conditions. But the fact remains that you now have your mantra, which you repeat in your head, and you might immediately begin to think about, well, what pattern of physiological changes and what's the person doing in his head when we meditate? Do meditators differ? Well, we ask that ourselves that question. And let me briefly tell you one experiment where we compared teachers of meditation who practice, as I said, this mantra quiet skill with people who are trained with what's called the Gurdjieff system, in which they're trained in all kinds of meditative gymnastics. This is very active meditation, a lot of their training skills. So imagine, here's one. You ought to try doing this. It feels very different than TM. What I want you to do is to look at this room and try to attend actively. Fill your consciousness with everything in the room. Try to hold everything into your mind. While you're doing that simultaneously, I want you to feel all the sensations in your body. I mean the sensations in your toes, sensations in your ankles, sensations in your knees, sensations in your stomach, sensations in your breathing, sensations in your... Fill your consciousness with everything that's going on in your body. At the same time, you're looking at all of that stuff that's going on outside, and hold all that there. Well, most people find that really difficult to do. Also, most people wonder why anyone would want to do that, but that's another story. The fact of the matter is that some people practice this. They develop a skill. That skill is as unique, though different, as is the skill of passively attending to a mantra. Now, when you're attending to something with your eyes, what are you doing? Physiologically, well, we know you're using what's called your occipital cortex, which is where your eyes are attached to. When you attend to your body, what you're doing instead is using another part of your brain called the sensory motor strip. And so therefore, when you're attending with your eyes, you're using this part of your brain. When you're attending to your body, you're using this part of your brain. And therefore, if I have you voluntarily look versus attend to your body, what should go on in your head? You should activate this part of your brain or activate this part of your brain, depending upon what you're doing. Well, we ran an experiment. We predicted that that would, in fact, occur, and that people who practice the Gurdjieff system should be much better at voluntarily looking or attending to their body than people who have no training, that is a control group. And the control group may, in fact, be somewhat better than the TM meditators, because the TM meditators do not practice active meditation, nor do they attend either to their body or to the visual world. What do they practice? An auditory verbal task. Well, we did such an experiment, And that's exactly what we found. The Gurdjieff people were different than controls. The controls were different than the TM. By the way, it was in fact, though, true that the people who practiced transcendental meditation were nonetheless the most physiologically relaxed. I'm not therefore arguing that what you want to do to relax, that is the average time, is to sit filling your consciousness with everything that's going on in your body. But I did want to suggest to you the idea that maybe different meditation procedures involve different patterns or structures, and therefore will have different subjective experiences and different consequences. Well, where does this all lead to more practical applications of, if you will, mind control? Well, let me suggest to you that all of these procedures have relevance to a new perspective on psychosomatic disorders, which is that we, in fact, exist in a biological structure composed of multiple systems, and that we can learn to acquire various controls over these systems with appropriate training and maybe some external devices like biofeedback. And that when we experience something like anxiety, anxiety is a gestalt. It's an emergent property of a pattern of underlying processes. And anxiety is not a throbbing heart. Anxiety is not chronic muscle tension. Anxiety is not an anxious thought of, oh my God, I've got a paper on Monday. Anxiety with a big A, if you will, is the integration of all of those processes in the same way that deep relaxation is the pattern of all of those. However, all of us don't, first of all, you and I are not trained to discriminate what systems we are experiencing any given symptom in at any given point in time. No one teaches you. Matter of fact, it's sort of amazing how you even learn to label your own experience as anxiety, let alone what kind of anxiety it is. Nor does anyone ever teach you how to relax. I'm sure some of you, when you want to relax, may listen to music. Sometimes you may listen to quiet music, right? You just feel like turning on the thing and listen to something like Bach or... You turn on jazz. You turn on rock and roll and you jump all around. Well, who teaches you what kind of music to put on to deal with what kind of stress? Or sometimes you're anxious and what do you want to do? Sit down passively, put your head in front of a television set and just look, right? Other times, you can't sit still watching television, can you? And so what do? You go running around looking for something to do. You tinker, you garden, you cook, you clean, you do whatever you can find. Well, who teaches you what you should do to deal with what components of anxiety? Well, that's not a simple question, but it's one that I think researchers in this area are trying to deal with. And maybe one approach to do that, to deal with this, is to break up our own consciousness and our own physiology into these subcomponents that make some sort of sense, and then isolate these subcomponents, find out which they are, and pick the treatment regime that best meets the specific paradigm. So, for example, let me give you the simplest of cases. What we call, Richard Davidson and I, a state of high cognitive, low somatic anxiety. High cognitive being visual images or auditory images and mental activity, versus somatic, meaning skeletal, meaning peripheral. High cognitive, low somatic. You're lying in bed, late at night, physically exhausted. You're so tired you can't move. I mean, you're not tossing and turning. You can't move. You don't even have enough strength to turn the alarm clock on. But you can't fall asleep because your mind is racing with unwanted thoughts and feelings, unwanted thoughts and images. What do you do? Well, what my grandmother taught me to do, she said, visualize and count sheep. And we sort of laugh at that. That's folklore. But I like to know what we're doing with our heads and why it is that, for example, under what conditions counting sheep works. So I started thinking back. Well, what do you do when you count sheep with your brain? First of all, you picture a sheep in your mind. That uses visual cortex, and it uses what side of the brain? The right, visualizing. So you now tie up the visual part of the brain by generating an image that's hopefully reasonably pleasant.
Now you've got this sheep in your mind, so you've got rid of that stuff. But what's the other side of your brain saying? Damn it, I've still got to write a paper tomorrow. The left side of the brain can be relatively separate from the right. And so what your grandmother said is, don't just picture the sheep, count them. And when you count them, now you're using the left side of your brain, tied up with the right side of your brain. Also, she told you that if you lose count, what do? Get all upset? No. Start all over. Sort of like TM. Start all over. The important thing is that you get your mind occupied and therefore fall asleep. Now that relates to this question, for example, of the mantra in TM. I genuinely do not believe, it's my belief, and based on other and published data as well, that it doesn't really matter what the specific mantra is. Although obviously certain words are better than others. I'm sure all of you could have certain words in your mind that if you repeated them over and over, they would make you sick. You don't want to pick those words. But once you've got a word, almost any word that's pleasant, the trick is to do what? To say it, to attend to it, and to practice it. Now, if I told you, hey, don't go to that guy for $125. For 50 cents, I'll give you a word. It'll just be fine. Well, some people would come. But the point is, would you value my word as much? You'd say, oh, he gave me a cheap word. And now if you make it secret, if you make the word secret, what does that do also? It makes the word also special. It's yours. You'll be likely to think about it, won't you? Because it's your special word. So in other words, by having been instructed in this way, you will be more attached to your word, which means you'll be more likely to use your word, which means you'll be more likely to practice with your brain what you should practice for the sake of your health. Let's consider another example now, though, of high somatic, low cognitive anxiety. This is the other extreme. You're now lying in bed late at night, tossing and turning in bed. You can't sit still. You're jumping all around. You toss one side, you toss the other side. There's nothing in your mind that's bothering you. I mean, in fact, you'd like to think about, for example, you might be picturing in your mind a lovely beach. And as you picture this lovely beach, what are you doing? Tossing and turning. Is counting sheep going to work for you then? Probably not. The reason being that your anxiety in this case is not in your visual system, it's not in your auditory system, your anxiety is in your skeletal system. So you've got to get rid of that. One way to do that is to practice what's called progressive relaxation, in which you tense and relax all the different muscles in your body, which therefore ties up your skeletal system, then leads you to relax that system and therefore go to sleep. If that doesn't work, what will you do? Hopefully get up and do some exercises. Do some push-ups. Get rid of the tension. Jog. Punch a punching bag. Do something that will activate your skeletal system, therefore releasing the tension and allowing you to get to sleep. Well, how does this relate to facial expression? Let me tell you about how I learned it in myself, and then I'll get close to ending this talk. Here I am, supposedly, a psychologist who's concerned with teaching people to relax for the sake of their health, using biofeedback, meditation, and whatnot, and putting it into neuropsychological perspective. Meanwhile, I've got all kinds of things that bother me. And how am I going to ever go out and help someone else if I can't even help myself? Well, one of the things that I developed as I began to do research and give talks was I developed a fear of airplanes. I frankly did not like to fly. Flying keeps you from doing certain kinds of things, needless to say, in one's professional life. And I felt here's a perfect case of me applying my own self-regulation skills to deal with this problem. So I said, where are my problems? Well, the first problem that I had was I didn't know anything about flying. And I would look out the window, for example. We'd be coming down into Boston, and there's a lot of water around there. I think you have the same thing in Vancouver. And I'm looking out the window, and all I see is water. And the plane keeps coming closer and closer. I look out the window, and all I see is war. And I say, oh, my God, we're going to crash. And then at the last minute, the runway is there, and everything is fine. So I said, wait a second. Why am I so frightened? Every single time, at least that I've been in a plane, and it's happened quite a bit of times, we're going down the water, I get all afraid, look out the window, and then it gets to the runway, and everything's fine. I said, well, let me go learn about planes. It turns out that the pilot has a different window than I do. He has a window in front of the plane. And unlike me and the rest of the passengers, he can see the runway. So he knows he's not going to crash. Matter of fact, if he were sitting where I was sitting, and he didn't know what I didn't know, he'd have hopefully the same fears that I did. So the point is, one thing that you can do is help a person by reinterpreting what he sees, which is a lot which goes on in psychotherapy. So now, now I'm sitting in the plane, mind you. I've read my books about airplanes. I know everything that's going to happen. I'm sitting there saying, we're not going to crash. The runway's going to come up soon. But I'm sitting there all like this. I'm cognitively all right, but I'm somatically a wreck. I've still got this residual of my somatic tension. So what do I then do? I practice deep muscle relaxation. I learn to relax all the muscles in my body. I still find myself thinking about the airplane, though, so then what do? I pick one of my favorite mantras, and I start practicing what we call TM. And now, mind you, I'm sitting in an airplane, looking a little silly to the average stewardess, coming into the airport. My muscles are now relaxed. I'm thinking to myself my favorite mantra, which, by the way, for me, is the word one, and that's also what Dr. Herbert Benson uses very effectively with his individuals. One like Om, it works very well. I'm sitting there all relaxed. I'm not worried about the plane coming in, but I'm not enjoying flying. I'm not happy. I said, why aren't I happy? I'm sitting here all relaxed. I'm supposed to be happy. And then I said, wait a second. But I'm not doing anything to be happy. A, I'm not thinking any happy thoughts. And B, my face is not in a happy state. So what I've got to do is I've got to generate a happy pattern if I want to feel happy now that I'm relaxed. And there is, in fact, research on this now. So what I started doing is putting my chest out a little, generating a little bit of a smile, thinking about the fun I'm going to have when I land in the plane, and really looking silly. But you know, it's a great way to fly. Now, I don't mean to imply that just simply putting on a happy face will take away all of your problems. But I do wish to imply that putting on a happy face is one component of the total gestalt, which we mean by happiness. And that if we learn to do that, hopefully we can help other people plus ourselves to feel genuine happiness. Well, can I take 5 more minutes, Dan?
Sure.
Okay. Where does this leave us? We now see an area of research which I find very exciting, of which there are many more questions than there are answers, about trying to develop ways of looking at our systems, of multiple systems, and then attacking those multiple systems and putting them back together to treat the total pattern. In medicine, in this new approach, which is called systems theory, is also called holistic medicine, which is to look at the entire person, all of the components. That health and disease takes place in a body that lives in an environment with a mind. That mind and brain and body are all integrated in one. And if you're ever going to treat any component of the system, you should try to deal with all of the components to get that final emergent property. This idea of emergent property, which is that the whole is different from the sum of its parts, yet totally dependent upon the sum of its parts for its unique properties, is seen at all levels of physics, biology, chemistry, and I suggest to you even at neuropsychology. At every single level, we see this, as far as I'm concerned, it's the greatest mystery in nature. This phenomena, that every level is somehow different from the one below it, yet dependent upon the one below it for its unique properties. An example that I'm sure you can all recognize is oxygen and hydrogen and water. Oxygen and hydrogen are two gases. They're both clear. We can't see them. We can't smell them. They each have their own individual sets of properties. But if you put them together under the right conditions, what do you get? A clear liquid called water. Now, water is very different in its properties from either hydrogen or oxygen. Right? Matter of fact, as far as I know, and you may correct me, physicists still don't have the foggiest idea in terms of the transformation rules, how you get from the individual properties of hydrogen and oxygen to the unique set of properties that water has. But despite our inability to understand those transformation rules, we still should not doubt that water is composed of two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen for its unique event. And I suggest to you that the same thing takes place in our own being when we experience anxiety or depression or happiness or sadness, that very often it's composed of this integrated property of muscle tension and autonomic processes, all in our brains and merged. And at different points in time, we experience different ways. So now we have this new conceptualization, possibly, to how we're built and some of the magic beyond that. We develop a new technology for helping people to help themselves. The question is it enough? If we develop the technology, do we now have a panacea that we can go out and apply? Just pick the right person, give them TM, give them jogging, give them biofeedback, throw in a little drugs, and everything will be fine. I think no. And the reason is that any self-regulation skill, any self-regulation program, not only requires that a person learn the skill, but more important, requires that he use the skill in his real life for the sake of his health. This was brought home to me with one of our early hypertensive patients who we were treating for biofeedback in an experimental program. We were paying these individuals to come to the laboratory for daily sessions to lower their blood pressure with biofeedback and therefore hopefully to improve their health. We were paying them to be better. People came in once a day, 5 days a week. We were showing them slides from no nude females or anything. These were just landscapes from around the world, plus monetary bonuses. And a good patient who came regularly every week plus lowered his blood pressure could earn like $35 or $40 for the week. 5 hours. That's not bad. Well, one of the men came in, and over the course of 5 days, he'd lowered his blood pressure by 20 to 25 millimeters of mercury. Fantastic. Go out on the weekend, come back on Monday, his blood pressure would be up again. We then go out and give him more feedback training. He'd lower his blood pressure, down 20, 25 millimeters, earn $35, $40, come back on Monday again, his blood pressure would be high. After we had done this for 3 or 4 weeks, we said, wait a second. Let's break the experimental code and find out what this man is doing on the weekend. So we asked him. He said, what are you doing on the weekend? He said, well, I go to the racetracks. And I gamble. And he almost invariably loses. And it hit us that the likelihood of teaching this man through biofeedback to relax while losing money at the racetracks was sufficiently slim that we were going to have to work on other components of this person's personality and his behavior at a racetrack if we were ever going to help him help himself. Now, hypertension is an unusual disorder. It's an unusual disorder because not only aren't we consciously aware of the symptoms, but more importantly, we don't receive the pain, the negative feedback from the pain, until it's too late. We are lacking this built-in biological system which would motivate us and force us to get help. Now, unfortunately, for those systems that do have this built-in pain, like tension, headache, and so on, we are no longer in this 20th century listening to the wisdom of what our body had to tell us in Cannon's words. And let me give you the example, and that's how I'll end this talk. This is what I call sometimes a word against Alka-Seltzer. And it goes essentially as follows. How does your stomach go about telling your head that you're working too hard or eating too much or eating on the run, doing the wrong kinds of things? Well, the stomach knows only how to do one thing, and that is it causes pain. It generates a set of signals that go up into the head, which our brain processes and experiences as unpleasant, right? Now, the brain doesn't want to listen to its stomach. I mean, no one wants a stomach ache. And so the first thing we do is we try to ignore it. But if the stomach ache gets sufficiently strong, it really will direct our attention, won't it? And any of you who have ever had a really good stomach ache knows that with a really good stomach ache, what do you think about? Nothing else but how do I get rid of that stomach ache? Now, in the olden days, that is before modern technology and modern medicine, this would serve as a cue to force us, force our brains and therefore us, to change our behavior or change our environment for the sake of our health. It was an adaptive negative control feedback loop. But now we say, I don't want to change my eating. I love apple pie. And I don't want to change going to the movies and doing this and doing that and driving down, you know, across the Lion Gates Bridge to go to the shopping center and then rush back for a dinner party and so on. I don't want to change it. Anyway, I can't. I can't control my environment. It's too hectic. So I'm not going to change my environment. I'm not going to change my behavior. So what am I going to do instead? Change my body. And so we develop with 20th century technology something like Alka-Seltzer. And it's really reinforced throughout the land. You see commercials that say, like a couple of years ago, eat, eat, right? You see a man gobbling all of this apple pie. Eat, eat. And if you get a stomach ache, don't listen to your stomach. Do what? Take Alka-Seltzer. Or you see a man and his wife shopping on the basement. I don't know what you'd have comparable here, but in Boston it's called Jordan Marsh. It's a basement, you know, a bargain store, and it's Christmas time, and everybody is all around grabbing packages and bumping into you. Nothing that a human being should ever be exposed to. He wasn't meant to live like that. But there you are shopping, last-minute shopping, trying to get your presents, having eaten a McDonald's on the run. And you start getting a stomach ache. What's the stomach telling you? You weren't meant to live like that. Or at least I wasn't meant to live like that, says the stomach. And what do we say instead? Don't listen to your stomach. Take Alka-Seltzer. Now, if Alka-Seltzer doesn't work, you take something stronger, and there are a lot of good ones around. If that doesn't work and the stomach begins to really break down, you get an ulcer. At which point, what do? You go to your physician and he patches you up, hopefully. If he can't patch you up and you continue to develop the problem, what does he do then? He cuts off the negative feedback loop or the neural control to the stomach altogether so that you don't experience the pain and the stomach doesn't become overreactive. And if that doesn't work, what's going to happen 20 years from now, maybe even 10 years from now? You'll go to your local hospital and you'll get a new stomach. An artificial stomach that won't break down when you're eating on the run and it won't cause you pain. It'll be a great stomach. This is happening throughout the medical world, throughout all of the drugs, throughout all of the surgery. And my point is that each time you go out and break down this natural built-in homeostatic loop, what do we end up doing? We end up doing more of the things that we weren't necessarily originally built to do for the sake of our health. I don't mean to imply that therefore I'm all against medicine, people shouldn't take drugs, that surgery should be eliminated and so forth. But what I'm suggesting instead is that maybe we're using it indiscriminately. Maybe we're using it too often. And that fact, maybe what we should do is to listen more to the wisdom of our body and somehow develop some sort of an incentive to endure pain and listen to pain, to appreciate our own biological structure, not as a negative thing, but as a positive thing for the sake of our happiness and the sake of our health. I don't know whether that'll happen. I don't know whether education programs and so on will lead people to utilize these skills that we're developing in medicine and psychiatry for the sake of their help. But I certainly hope so, and that's the note I'd like to leave you with. Thank you.
Usual tradition of the Institute, Dr. Schwartz has agreed to answer questions from the audience. I'm sure there are lots. Yes.
Period. It smelled to me very much like susceptibility to hypnosis to see if they were such people. And I wondered in your subject whether you studied the rate at which they caught on to your stuff, whether they were related to susceptibility to hypnosis. The other question was that in our early days, Kuiism was a kind of biofeedback, I suppose. Do you know about it? Was it that?
Repeat the question, please.
Okay, the first question was by the gentleman suggesting that in certain forms of, certain uses of acupuncture, for example, in China, there's a certain preconditioning period in which you want to heighten, if you will, the suggestibility that the technique will work. In other words, you relax the patient. You may actually give him some certain drugs to make him feel a little drowsy or make him feel lightheaded. You make him feel that this technique is bound to work and it's going to work. And after you induce all of that, for certain individuals, acupuncture does work. And the question was, do these techniques, in fact, enhance the effects of acupuncture? Or for that matter, do they relate at all to any of the subjects in biofeedback or whatever that we're working with? And the related question to that was whether or not there are certain individuals who are more suggestible in general and therefore more responsive to these techniques. Well, first of all, yes, I think that if you, again, from a psychobiological perspective, if you can put the brain in a certain state, it may be more receptive for certain things that you will do to it. And so therefore, doesn't it all surprise me that there are certain conditions which might be more effective in inducing, for example, reduction in pain than others? The same thing with the biofeedback. Although there's been very little work done, for example, whether or not hypnotic induction procedures are more lead people to have more effective control of their heart rate or not, that is not known. We have not studied it myself, although one of the questions that I'm becoming fascinated in, partly, in point of fact, part of the reason why I came here, is of work, major, very important work, being done in the psychology department here by the chairman, head of the department, Dr. Peter Sueffeld, on sensory deprivation and its effects on enhancing self-control. And we're going to consider the possibility that by reducing sensory input for some period of time, it will both enhance people's ability to control their physiology and also continue to motivate them to control it outside. So that's future research. I don't know of any research published yet on correlates on hypnotizability and biofeedback control for any physiological processes. I do know that certain people, with regard to imagery, people who are highly suggestible hypnotically will tend to be those who also show, for example, the cooling when they imagine that their hand is on the ice cube. The second question, which I can't exactly repeat, is, did you know fact X or thing X in medicine that was long ago used that's related to biofeedback? What was that thing X? Kuiism. I am growing better and better. Well, the term biofeedback, I didn't know that, no. The term biofeedback usually refers to some sort of enhanced information of oneself. So, for example, if you were to take your own pulse, like a runner sometimes does, to either to improve his performance in certain ways, that's a biofeedback loop, okay? The other components about instructing yourself to control certain time things, that falls within more general psychology. But I think, yes, it's important. Question?
Could I just comment on the last word there? Sorry. The biofeedback, I happen to, regarding the biofeedback, I'm a layman. I haven't been to right field for about 5 years, but they have done there some unusual work on feedback using various types of transforms
In the case of optics, they have used transforms of the Lagrangian style and various mathematical types. And these feedbacks are actually showing a pattern only on the cortex, then taking the transform mathematically through a computer, feeding it back through the blind eye, and getting the picture. This is most interesting to me. One more comment. My wife in the Philippines has been subject to acupuncture numerous times. There never was any preconditioning. The effects were done without any drugs, without preconditioning. There was feedback in that we did have a loop gain through a hand on an electrode and various needles in the circuit. I think it worked without the drug.
Thank you. Don't let me imply, by the way, that acupuncture only works because of suggestion. The published research that I've seen suggests that at least for certain points, and we've done related research on this, that it is true that pressing certain neurons, certain neural pathways, will, so it is believed, shut off a gate at the spinal cord and therefore reduce the pain input that in fact goes up to the brain. Now, not all of the classic points in the Chinese or whatever acupuncture things are in fact what they think there are. But there are certain cases, matter of fact, even using surface electrodes to stimulate over certain neural pathways that will result in the reduction in pain over other parts of the body. And those are relatively independent of any kind of preconditioning whatsoever.
Could I ask?
We better give somebody else a chance. Well, okay. Thank you. Yes.
Well, that's certainly a hope that somehow if we can find out what it is that's going on in our brain, for example, with creativity or with visual imagery or whatever, if we can then have that feedback, we can use that information to aid us to enhance those skills. I must confess, I'm somewhat skeptical about those kinds of applications. And the reason is only because of the problems involved in building in that perfect feedback loop. For example, if I put EEG electrodes over the visual part of your brain, you can activate your EEG either, for example, by looking or, for example, by generating a visual image. Those two different skills will have different consequences. One of them, for example, if you're generating an image, you're not going to be able to see as well. So if you're talking about using occipital alpha biofeedback to enhance visual perception, it might not work because you have competition. Similarly, if you want to develop imagery, how do you know that the subject's in fact not looking? Well, maybe one of the things you can do is close his eyes. The point that I mean to imply is that maybe we just haven't developed enough of the technology for specifying what the pattern of processes are so that the person is really getting feedback for the thing and only the thing that you want him to practice. And I think that's going to take a number of years to determine what those may be. But again, that's only my opinion.
Over here.
Are you aware of any instances where people have used biofeedback to inadvertently enhance physiologically detrimental function?
Question is, have I heard any instances where biofeedback led to increased physiological problems? Is that what you're saying? The cases I have heard of side effects of biofeedback, but more of them involved with drugs. That is, a person might be given training for
let's say, general muscle relaxation and in particular frontalis muscle relaxation, and go into insulin shock. The reason being that the person's, whereas before the person needed X amount of insulin to maintain he or herself because she was diabetic, somehow as a result of biofeedback, she no longer needs as much insulin. And so consequently, because he or she is still on this amount of insulin, it has a negative effect. Now, of course, you can turn that around positively and say, gee, that's remarkable. If we could somehow train a person to control certain patterns of activity and therefore lead them not to need as much drug as they did before, in other words, if you can't get rid of it, at least to reduce it, that would really be quite remarkable. And there's one case that will be published in the forthcoming issue of the New Journal of Biofeedback and Self-Regulation that makes that very point. I have not heard of any person, for example, with cardiac arrhythmias being given feedback for heart rate and developing, for example, a heart attack. But there again, it's because the people who are hopefully doing this work, like cardiologists, are very careful to make sure that their patients are controlling what they should do. Now, the one exception, again, to that point is that there has been research, particularly out of the Baltimore City Hospital by Dr. Bernie Engel, who has trained his individuals with a variety of cardiac arrhythmias, such as preventricular contractions, to both decrease and increase the frequencies of those arrhythmias through biofeedback techniques. But again, not to the point of increasing negative health, but rather just as part of the process of teaching them to control it for the sake of their health. You know, the question was, have we done anything with telepathy or any other paranormal phenomena in its relationship to biofeedback? First of all, it always amazes me how almost every, if you give the expression, kooky thing in the scientific area and psychology today sort of gets thrown under the broad heading of biofeedback, meditation, paranormal, acupuncture, anything that's strange and unusual, we put into that general category. Some of us try not to have it be that way. But be that as it may, have I done any research in that area? The answer is no. Do I have an interest in that research? I must confess, yes. One of my students at Harvard, before he came to work with me, had worked with a man by the name of Dr. Stanley Krippner, who's a well-known ESP researcher from the Maimonides Hospital. And they had been doing research on EEG correlates of ESP ability and found out, again, I'm only reporting the data, that individuals who tended to have higher amounts of alpha and theta tended to be more sensitive in, for example, guessing cards. He also performed an experiment which suggested that by training people to maintain an alpha-theta state, general state in their brain, that their ESP performance was improved. Now, all I'm doing is reporting the data, and I don't have at all an explanation for that. It's also not established scientific fact.
Yeah, on this question of going to sleep while your mind is active, I found after experimenting with listening to all kinds of music that it doesn't work. The one thing that will put me to sleep instantly is to listen to something I'm really interested in. In fact, so much so. what I found that when I put the radio on, let's say three lectures in like that, I even put it into the recorder on, just in case I'm always speaking. You know that some of the lectures I have not heard yet, because every time I put them on, I fall asleep.
That's a very interesting example. Well, I can give you my tentative explanation. It may relate back to the business of why do you want to spend $125 for a mantra that you don't tell anyone? And that is, if a certain stimulus has such potential that it will really attract your attention, meaning now in neurological terms that Your brain will process that information and not process other things or generate other things. If the reason why you're having trouble sleeping is because you've got all of this stuff going on and you want to do it relatively effortlessly, it would be nice if you could get something that would, so to speak, tie up your brain and get rid of all the other things so therefore it can fall asleep. That may be the explanation, but it's only a guess.
We have time for one or two more questions. Back there.
Okay. The question is, has anyone done any research to see how high you can teach a person to control, to raise his blood pressure? What effect does it have? And is it related, for example, to muscle tension in the arm? I do not know of any published research where people's goals have been to teach people to raise their blood pressure as high as possible. There are various ethical considerations in doing that kind of work, at least where I come from. No, I wasn't implying that it would be that way here, but there are some places where really crazy things are allowed to happen. I do know examples where individuals have inadvertently raised their blood pressures very high. Certainly in my own laboratory, that's happened. And we have specific cutoff points where if a person's getting into the hypertension range, we stop them. Now, the subjective reports of people who have gotten themselves blood pressure really high have been very similar to what you would experience in terms of both anger and anxiety. I mean, these people are genuinely shaken when they happen to do that. And if you look at the total pattern of their activity, their voice will be shaking, they will be showing various kinds of, you know, tension throughout much of the body, and so on. What's really an interesting question is, why is it that certain individuals will tend to show such large increases in blood pressure and heart rate with relatively little training, and others show almost none whatsoever? Do those really large increases mean that these people have exceptional control? Or are they, in fact, the kinds of individuals who have the capability to have their blood pressure and heart rate break loose and therefore be the ones to more likely show cardiovascular disease under stress? That question's not answered yet. Okay. The first point was that, you know, why do you need to learn about airplanes and coming in? Why don't you just close the window and that would be fine? For certain individuals, closing the window is just fine. For other individuals, they find themselves still worrying. And in fact, they worry more as a result of not being able to see what's happening. That depends on the individual. I would like to have, you know, everybody look out the window if possible, although if it works for you by just closing the window, all's well and good. The second question is, isn't biofeedback really nothing more than a psychological Alka-Seltzer? Well, first of all, I think many people originally thought that that's what it would be. People would come to us for biofeedback therapy, and they say, we'd look at their total behavior, their total physiology, and we'd come out for the fact they're eating too much, they're running around too much, they're smoking too much, they're doing all kinds of other things, plus they've got a weak heart. And now they don't want to go on drugs, or they can't go on drugs because it causes side effects until they come to biofeedback. You know what they say? They come wanting sort of a non-pharmacological pill. They say, look, I want to learn to lower my blood pressure so I can go out and continue doing what I'm doing now without it being high. And my prediction is that that won't work, just like me sitting on the scale, losing some weight, and say, oh boy, now I can have some apple pie. I don't think it works in that fashion. And that's one of the reasons why I like it better than the simple Alka-Seltzer pill.
Way back there.
Meditation seems to form of sensory deprivation. Okay, I think most of you heard the question. There's been some reports, and actually they've been around for quite a while, that prolonged sensory deprivation can lead to hallucinations. And is this possibly what might happen in certain forms of meditation? Well, the answer is, I think, yes, it can happen in meditation. Matter of fact, my interest in sensory deprivation grew out of my interest in meditation and trying to find out what it is that goes on with meditation to lead to some of these effects. There are certain periods, certain individuals, for example, in India, who will spend a week to 2 weeks in self-induced sensory deprivation. They will go into a room with doors closed, with nothing except minimal food and water, and they will sit there and meditate for a week, 2, 3 weeks at a time, not coming out. Now, the question is, do those individuals come out of there with, for example, having strong hallucinations and so on? The average person, at least the reports that I've heard, is yes, they have very often have unusual forms of imagery that is elicited as a result of the fact that you're no longer being flooded with external stimulation. The question is it necessarily bad? Does it hurt you? Does it stay with you so when you leave the sensory deprivation chamber or whatever the case may be, now all you do is you walk around and you see little green men following you? My impression is that moderate degrees of sensory deprivation don't hurt you. They do lead to increased fantasy. And in fact, that may be part of the reason why sensory deprivation can really help you, because it leads you to spend some portion of your life sitting back and attending to your own thoughts and behavior rather than attending to everything else. And that may be part of the way that you go about restructuring your own lifestyle. But again, you put the wrong person under those conditions with the wrong set for the wrong period of time, and you can cause some real problems.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we could go on with many more questions. Let me first of all say that for those of you who wish to stay with Professor Schwartz and myself and others, that there will be coffee out in the foyer after the lecture now. And it remains merely to thank the speaker. Perhaps the best form of thanks is if you would all, perhaps for 30 seconds, join me in using the right side of your brain. But I will ask Professor John Milsom to use the left side of his brain and say a few words.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a very interesting experience, I think, tonight. In a sense, I think it's very obvious the excitement that you've all felt, partly demonstrated by the numbers of you that are here tonight. I think we've listened to an exciting story in terms of how science really should be, and also a personal odyssey of a man who has been led on from one thing to another, and of particular interest to me in that I feel I've paralleled some of the things that he's been talking about in my own personal concerns. I was particularly interested in his psychiatrist story that got such interesting data from the psychoanalyst. I'm reminded of the story of the hot, probably Bostonian summer, where the physicians at the end of the day were all tumbling out at the end of this hot day and coming down the elevator. And one of the physicians who actually has to get his hands dirty remarked to his psychiatrist colleague, "Well, it's all very well for you people. You can, you know, all you have to do there is sit and listen." And the psychiatrist said, "Who listens?" I like a term, the technological imperative, to describe some of the dangers that Dr. Schwartz has been warning us about. At first, I was a little afraid he wasn't going to be warning us about it, but in the end, he came out with a very strong message that he was, which is why I described it as an odyssey in the first place. Now, in that same magazine that he talked about, the Playboy, there was an article at some time ago called "She Had the Best Sweetbreads That Money Could Buy." And this was the story carried to its logical left hemisphere conclusion. of a person, of a doctor, of a Frankenstein and his generator, if you wish, who, in fact,